Please rise. This court is now in session.
Please be seated.
Thank you.
Will the clerk please call the first case in the morning?
322-0292, People of the State of Illinois, appealed by Scott Piles versus Carl Farrell, appealed by John Padlow.
Counsel, you may proceed.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel, and assembled members of the audience. My name is John Partolo, and I represent Carl Farrell, who's the appellant in this case. Mr. Farrell is a 41-year-old African-American male, a resident of Will County. He's currently a father, a union plumber, an activist, and a civically engaged in his community. When Mr. Farrell was younger, he was the subject of three felony cases, two in Will County and one in Cook. All of those cases were drug-related. I had felony convictions in each of those cases.
What were those felony convictions for?
They were for possession of drugs. The final one in Will County was for possession, and he was charged with a UUW, an unlawful use of a weapon. When the police entered the home, there were six people in the living room. He was on the floor, several other people sleeping on the floor. There was a gun underneath the sofa. Since he was the closest one to it, they charged him with that. No use of the weapon, no violent crimes. They were all drug-related with the addition of that particular crime.
Just possession? Simple
correct.
Possession?
Correct.
Not with intent to sell?
Not true. Two of the convictions were with intent, correct, to deliver.
Okay, so it's not just possession?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
The last conviction was in 2010. Mr. Farrell has served all of the sentences that were levied. He's served all supervisory and probationary requirements, and all of those were completed more than 12 years ago. In the fall of 2020, Mr. Farrell, who is civically engaged in his community, sought to become a candidate for Joliet Township Trustee. He pursued the candidacy, he was nominated, he got his name on the ballot, he campaigned, and he was elected as a Joliet Township Trustee in the municipal election in April of 2021. At no time between the time he sought the candidacy and the time he was elected in April of 2021 were there any objections to his candidacy or any complaints filed. Mr. Farrell was elected and then took office in May of 2021. To this day, other than the quo warranto action filed by the state's attorney in this case, there's never been a complaint or any objection filed to Mr. Farrell's candidacy, election, or his service in office. Mr. Farrell served from May 2021 until today, where he still serves, with some voluntary refraining from some of his duties after the state's attorney made some threatening comments and remarks and letters to the supervisor of the township, basically saying Mr. Farrell is not eligible, he should step down, don't pay him. As a matter of fact, because of the state's attorney's request, they suspended Mr. Farrell's pay for several months during the pendency of this case. In March of 2022, the state's attorney of Will County filed a quo warranto complaint. That was preceded by several months of demands that Mr. Farrell resign from the position because he was allegedly ineligible. The state's attorney sought a preliminary injunction and a TRO to remove Mr. Farrell immediately from the bench. Mr. Farrell contested those things and won.
Not from the bench, right?
I'm sorry, did I say from the bench? I apologize.
Yes. Yeah.
From his position.
Yes.
Filed an answer in the case, and he raised three affirmative defenses. His affirmative defenses were latches, Secondly, the unconstitutionality of the statutory scheme in which the state's attorney deemed Mr. Farrell ineligible for the office. And finally, Mr. Farrell has and still has pending pending petition before the governor for a pardon slash restoration of rights. So that petition is still pending. His original hearing was set for July 12th before the Prisoner Review Board, and that has been continued because of some tumult with the Prisoner Review Board, and that hearing is presently scheduled for this week, Thursday, October 6th, on the petition for a pardon. Each of the affirmative defenses provides a sufficient basis all on its own to reverse the trial court and keep Mr. Farrell in office. The trial court, on an accelerated schedule, invited cross motions for summary judgment. There was very limited discovery in the case. The cross motions were submitted, and the trial court ruled denying Mr. Farrell's motion for summary judgment on all three of the affirmative defenses and granting the state's motion for summary judgment, and entered an order on June 24th that declared the office vacant and declared Mr. Farrell ineligible because of his felony convictions to hold the office. At the hearing for the motion on summary judgment, the state's attorney for the first time raised the defense that Mr. Farrell failed to comply with Supreme Court Rule 19 in failing to give proper notice based on his claim of unconstitutionality. That was the subject of a motion to reconsider. Shortly after the issue was first raised by the state's attorney, notice was given directly to the Attorney General by letter. That letter is part of the record. That notice was given on June 27th and incorporated into the motion to reconsider. The trial court heard the motion to reconsider and ruled that the motion to reconsider was improper, that notice was required under Rule 19. Although notice had been given, it was late and it did not comply with Rule 19. And based on that ruling, the trial court declined to further consider the constitutionality arguments raised by Mr. Farrell. So the trial court ultimately made a ruling on affirmative defenses 1, latches, and 3, the pending petition for a pardon or restoration of rights before the governor, and declined to make a substantive ruling on the second affirmative defense, which is our claim of unconstitutionality. There are two red herrings in this case, and I'll get to them in order as I go, but the first red herring is a defense of unclean hands that's been raised by the state to defeat the latches argument. That is the first red herring, and I'll address that in just a moment. The second red herring is Supreme Court Rule 19 violation. Both of those things, again, are red herrings, and the court should disregard them. They're not properly decided, and I'll explain in just one moment. First, I'll address the latches argument. Defendant has raised latches as an affirmative defense to the quo warranto claim. Latches, as the court no doubt knows, is originally an equitable defense. There's a long line of cases in the last 20 or 25 years here in Illinois that provide that latches can also be used as a defense in legal claims. Specifically, and I've cited these cases in my brief, the courts have held that latches is a proper defense in a quo warranto action. Now, there are cases out there that say that latches cannot be raised against the government when they file a quo warranto. However, there is one case that finds that there is an exception. That case, People X Rel Hanrahan versus Wheeling, holds that latches can be used if two things are present. One, there's an inexcusable delay by the bringer of the quo warranto complaint, coupled with public acquiescence. Secondly, the judgment of ouster, if entered, has to cause and will result in great public inconvenience and detriment. We argued before the trial court, and the trial court rejected this argument, that both of those elements are present here. First, state's attorney took almost 1 year from the time Mr. Let me back up. 18 months from the time Mr. Farrell placed his name in nomination, sought the candidacy, received the candidacy, got his name on the ballot, and pursued election to the position of Joliet Township Trustee.
Is the state's attorney, is that his job to do that? To examine those statements of candidacy and claims?
I would tell you that that is part of the broad range of things that he has in his toolbox, Judge. Is it first, second, or third on the list of things that the state's attorney pays attention to? I would suggest probably not. But he has, and the statute gives the state's attorney authority to bring a quo warranto action. Therefore, I would tell you that, yes, he has some responsibility for looking at candidacies. And perhaps not everyone who seeks a candidacy, but once they are the candidate, once they have been nominated, once they have their name on the ballot, and once they begin to campaign, I would say that there's a heightened responsibility to examine those. I would say that that responsibility becomes more heightened at the time he's elected. And you'll see that most of the cases out there in these quote warranto actions, all of the, not all of them, but the vast majority of them, the actions are initiated somewhere near the election or when a felony conviction happens during during the term of office. They happen shortly thereafter. So this is unusual. A 1 year delay.
Yeah, there's no notice given to the state's attorney where those other actions are probably was.
That's correct. There is no notice of in the other actions you talk about in the other cases, Judge. No, there was no notice. The state's attorney, I would say, stumbled on them in many of those situations, much like they did here. We raised it in the trial court. We believe that this action by the state's attorney was retaliatory for Mr. Farrell's activism. Essentially, as we understand it, and Mr. Farrell understands it, Judge, Mr. Farrell was involved in some Black Lives Matter protests. He was called in with other people to the state's attorney's office to discuss those protests. Someone at the state's attorney's office said, hey, I think that guy has a felony conviction, and the wheels began to turn, and they resulted in ultimately this quo warranto action being filed.
So what would that date be?
That date?
The date of filing candidacy. I mean, you're saying that on your latches, you've got to establish sleeping on rights.
Correct, and that date, the state's attorney will tell you that date was sometime in December of 2021, which would have been 5 or 6 months after the election.
Okay. Well, counsel, isn't it just as important for the candidate to file a truthful statement of candidacy?
Well, Judge, that's an argument that's been made very vigorously by the state's attorney. And I would suggest to you this. That is part of their unclean hands argument. I'll address it now. They would suggest to you that the what they've vehemently and repeatedly called the perjured statement of candidacy presents supports an unclean hands argument that would defeat any latches defense that we have here. I would say a couple of things on that. One, there wasn't any discovery. There were no depositions or anything like that. There's never been any proof, and there isn't any proof in the record, that the form statement of candidacy that a candidate fills out, and by filling out, I mean fill in a couple of blanks and hand it in because the clerk asks all of the candidates to do so. There's no evidence in the record that was intentionally falsified by Mr. Farrell. I believe that a good faith argument can be made and was made at the time that he believed he was eligible. I will get to that when we talk about the constitutional arguments, but I believe Mr. Farrell, I don't believe that statement of candidacy can be properly called false, much less intentionally false. And there's a case, a very clear case from the Illinois Supreme Court here from January of this year, January of 2022, PNC Bank versus Kuzmeres. And what that stands for, that case, among other things, is they specifically talk about the unclean hands defense. And they say in that case that to use the unclean hands defense, you have to raise it to the level of fraud. I've cited it later. It's a 2022 Illinois Supreme Court case. And it stands for two propositions that are important here. One, latches can even be applied when the judgment's void. So it is a defense to even avoid judgment. So and its second proposition that it stands for is, again, that unclean hands cannot be used as an effective defense unless you raise it to the level of actual fraud. I think we're far short here on Mr. Farrell's statement of candidacy, and I think that, again, is another red herring.
Well, you're not suggesting Mr. Farrell didn't remember his prior conviction?
Absolutely not. And he's never denied the convictions. In this case, we've never denied the convictions. We admitted them in our answer to the complaint. We believe that based on, and you'll see it in my argument about the unconstitutionality of the statutory scheme, we believe there's a reasonable argument that Mr. Farrell is eligible despite the language of the township code. There's a split in authority here in Illinois, and that there's only two Illinois appellate court cases. One is from 1980, Ryan versus Coles, and in that case, they specifically address a township office, and they specifically find that for the argument, the equal protection purposes, that there is no rational basis for the difference between constitutionally created offices and legislatively created offices. As you know, in the constitutional scheme here in Illinois, a felon, after serving his sentence, becomes immediately eligible to run for any constitutionally created office. So Mr. Farrell, upon completion of his sentence in 2010, could have immediately, without doing anything else, run for governor of the state of Illinois. He could not, at that same moment, run for any legislatively created offices, such as municipal offices or township offices, without getting a pardon from the governor. Ryan versus Coles holds that there is no rational basis. You're required in an equal protection analysis to have a rational basis for the difference between those two. And they don't. The competing case, and the state relies on this case, is People versus Hofer. That's a 2006 case in which they make the same equal protection analysis. They talk about the difference between constitutionally created offices and legislatively created offices. And they come to the conclusion that they find a rational basis for the difference in eligibility requirements. I find their reasoning wholly unpersuasive. Their reasoning, essentially distilled in a nutshell, is this. Legislatively created offices, like municipal offices and township offices, are lower level offices. They have much less scrutiny than a higher level constitutional office. Make the easy, obvious argument between governor and between township trustee. So their argument is because those lower level offices have what they opine to be less scrutiny, and they have, because of the nature of the office, they found that there was less ability to sort of watch over those offices and look into the candidates as there would be with someone who was running for a constitutionally created office, that there was a rational basis for making the distinction between you serve your sentence and you're eligible for a constitutional office. You got to go get a pardon from the governor after you serve your sentence to be eligible for any legislatively creative office. I don't find that persuasive. I believe that the Ryan versus Coles case, which was law for now 40 years, I think is the more persuasive case. I would suggest that in this day of the easy accessibility to online information, and the nature of legislatively created offices being more local offices, I would suggest that they are more closely scrutinized by the smaller cohort of the population that is governed by those offices. So, for example, in the case of Mr. Farrell, he's elected to a township trustee office. The people in that township certainly have the ability and are certainly much more information is much more accessible to them than back when the Hofer court back in 2006, I believe, or even when the Ryan versus Coles court was looking at it. I would suggest that those offices are the scrutiny available to the average citizen for those offices is equal to any scrutiny you'd have on a higher level office, and the information is equally accessible. So I don't see any rational basis whatsoever for the difference between constitutionally created offices and legislatively created offices.
So
That was one.
Your time is up. I see the red light has gone on.
Thank you very much.
And you'll have time in reply.
Very well. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. Counsel, you may respond.
Morning. My name is Scott Piles. I represent the people. May it please the court. Counsel, I will be brief. As you heard, counsel for Mr. Farrell, he has no defense to the substantive merits of the Quo Warranto petition. That being that he purportedly ran for Joliet Township trustee and that he was a convicted felon, and that the Township Code, Section 55-6, indicates that a person who has a felony conviction may not serve as a township trustee. The merits of the Quo Warranto petition filed by the people is not disputed. The fact that he's a convicted felon is not disputed, and the fact that the Township Code exists is not disputed. The issues here today are that Mr. Farrell is raising three affirmative defenses to his quest to purportedly remain in office, even though he does not meet the legislative mandated qualifications for said office, that being free of a felony conviction. Those three defenses are latches, because it took the people 6 months to uncover the fact that Mr. Farrell filed a false statement of candidacy indicating under oath that he was in fact qualified to serve in the office of township trustee. Number two, he's suggesting that the township code provision that does not allow felons to serve in township office violates the equal protection clause, because the legislature clarified the municipal code and the election code to indicate pre-existing and existing Illinois law that if a person's rights were in fact restored, that they could serve in those offices. Walker versus Apagua notes that the legislative amendment to the municipal code that added the paragraph talking about restorative rights simply just stated pre-existing and existing at the time law that if a person does have their rights restored by pardon or by the governor, that they could in fact then serve in that office. There's no longer a felony conviction if he receives a pardon. The impediment would be removed. And the third, which he did not address but it's in his brief, is that he would like this court to stay a ruling until there's action on his petition for pardon by the Illinois Prisoner Review Board, whether or not he's going to in fact receive a pardon for six felony convictions for drugs and weapons charges in both Will and Cook County. Now, as I stated both in the trial court and I stated in my brief, I think it's commendable that Mr. Farrell has turned to the right side of the law and that he's no longer committing those offenses since his release from the Illinois Department of Corrections. It's good. And we certainly want to encourage that. But the issue here is, can he serve in an elected capacity in the township of Joliet as a trustee? The answer to the question is no, because the legislature does not allow convicted felons to serve in those slots. Just like they don't allow convicted felons to serve on school boards, they don't allow them to serve in municipal boards. The distinction that Mr. Parlow talks about is that a constitutional office, if once you finish your sentence, you can run for governor. The courts are very clear. There's a distinction made on why there is a difference between constitutional officers that have the media scrutiny of being a constitutional office in Springfield, with the news media, with every action scrutinized by other elected officials, as opposed to being in a municipal or township office that does not have that scrutiny. That is the difference, and that is the rationale used in the Apagua cases that's present in the courts. And frankly, I think it's a reasonable and a rational basis to deny the equal protection argument here. Frankly, the other argument that's made with regard to the equal protection clause is, again, the wording distinction between the legislative change to the municipal code that allows us that put in a paragraph or a sentence that says that you can serve if there's a restoration of rights or a pardon issued. That really doesn't change what the law is. Frankly, if you receive a pardon, or if you get a restoration of rights, you are no longer considered to be a convicted felon. It's been forgiven. That impediment is removed. That change in the law didn't really do anything other than essentially being specific about what the law is, which essentially says that if you have a conviction and it is removed by the executive, you no longer have that felony conviction and you are now allowed to serve.
Let me go further. If there is a restoration of rights through the granting of a pardon, would you be here saying Mr. Carroll cannot serve today as a trustee?
No.
Why?
Let me back up a little bit. If you look at the statute says at the time of the taking of the oath,
correct,
you are not eligible. So, no. If he received a pardon today, I would suggest that I would probably still be here because at the time that he was required and he took the oath, he was not eligible for the office. I stated that the trial court, if the case was pending and he received a pardon, I would pack up my bags and go home. Because the impediment is removed, he would still be in office, technically. Although it's been our position.
Wait a minute. That's a different position than you just argued a minute ago.
Well, it's very difficult because Mr. Farrell does have a certificate of election. It's our position that at the time he took the oath, he was not eligible to serve in that office. But he is, in fact, right now exercising the powers of Joliet Township trustee.
So you wouldn't bring this legal question to court? Is it prosecutorial discretion you're going to invoke or what?
Justice, if he received a pardon today, I'm not sure what the position of the office would be. To be fair,
there is a statute.
No, I agree. There is a section in the statute that says at the required time of taking of the oath, that's really the issue. Is he eligible? The answer to that question is no. But we weren't, at the time he did take the oath, we were unaware that he had lied on his statement of candidacy. They spent a lot of time in their brief saying there was an objection to him running, there was an objection during the campaign, there was an objection to him entering the oath. It's because, frankly, the election code sets up some protections to the public that when they actually run for the office, they have to sign a notarized under oath statement saying that they are qualified to be in that office.
Is there anything on the form that says that a felony conviction is a violation, is an ineligibility? Or do you have to know the statute in order to be able to answer that question?
No, the form does not have the qualifications of the office. I think we're setting the bar pretty low, though, if we're going to allow somebody to serve in an elected office and for them not to know the base qualifications. We're setting the bar pretty low. What does a township trustee do? They vote on budgets. There are literally millions of dollars that flow through a township. I think, are we setting the bar so low that a person that runs for office does not know the base qualifications? I would suggest that we're not here in a criminal case.
Would your response be the old axiom, ignorance of the law is no excuse?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's a defense to say, well, I didn't know. That's why, in a record, my letter to Mr. Farrell lays out what we tried to do here. It's in the record. When we were notified, I called the township attorney and I advised him of the impediment. You have a trustee that has an issue. Talk to him and see what the response is. It isn't any different than I've done in other positions where somebody has a qualification. For example, if there's a member of the regional superintendent of schools that's a school board employee, that person cannot serve on the regional board. And it's not a matter of, you know, fairness and that. It's just that it's in the statute that says if you're an employee of a school district, you cannot serve in that capacity. That is very similar to what we have here. It's a disqualifier to hold the office. And I understand that, you know, there's a distinction in between, but if Mr. Farrell, at the time he took the oath, was unable to take that oath because of the felony conviction, The election is void ab initio. It's void at its inception. As to whether or not something is retroactive, and we're not at that point yet because Mr. Farrell has not received a pardon. There has not been a restoration of rights. I made arguments in the trial court. I don't know if Mr. Farrell would be a candidate for that relief. It's unknown. But the problem is that right now we have somebody that's purportedly trying to exercise the powers of Joliet Township trustee, and he is not qualified by virtue of his felony conviction. And he's voting on these budgets, he's voting on these ordinances, and he's voting on these matters before the board. Now, I'm going to respond to some of the arguments made that threats from the state's attorney's office and he wasn't getting paid and so forth. Well, the difficulty with that is that's not true. Mr. Farrell put forward an affidavit in this case indicating he wasn't getting paid.
What does that have to do with this case?
Well, it has a lot to do with it, Judge, Justice Holdridge, because number one, the basis of Mr. Farrell's petition here is that he's now a law-abiding citizen. But every time in this case, when there's been an opportunity to put something factual forward, it's not correct. Mr. Partolo raised the argument that I prevented him from getting paid, but when we check, Mr. Farrell continued to get paid. It's in the record on the motion to reconsider. Mr. Farrell continued to get paid, even though in the affidavit he says threats from the state's attorney's office were preventing me from getting paid. That was not factually accurate. Another affidavit, another opportunity where something was under oath, and it wasn't correct.
Does that go to the issues on appeal?
Justice, I would suggest that it goes
unless
to...
Unless you're trying to just correct the record.
I'm just trying to correct the record.
Oh, okay.
I want, because Mr. Parlow raised it in his argument, and I wanted to address that. I think this case is relatively simple. I don't think that any of the affirmative defenses raised by Mr. Farrell are enough to overcome his disqualification as a convicted felon to serve on this board. If Mr. Farrell had done it the right way, which is go get the pardon first, not file for the pardon after the quo warranto was filed, get the pardon first, then run for office, there would be no objection. Mr. Farrell could serve, everything would be fine. There would be no question about votes being taken by Mr. Farrell on the Joliet Township Board regarding the budgets and everything else. That was the way to do it. But that's not what was done here. What was done, runs for office, he files a false statement of candidacy, then takes the oath, then when he was confronted with the fact that he can't serve, then he files, after the quo warranto was filed, then he files for the pardon. It's kind of do it in reverse. Should be reversed the other way. Get the pardon first, then run for the office. I think the legislative mandate is very clear. And what Mr. Partolo and counsel for Mr. Farrell wants you to do, he wants you to invalidate a requirement under the township code on the basis of equal protection that convicted felons could serve in township office. Because that's a factual result. Tens of thousands of offices for township officials would now be open to convicted felons, which is not what the legislative mandate is. And he's basing that on the fact that because there was a wording change in the municipal code that treats municipal offices and township offices different in their argument. I would suggest there is no difference. The wording change in the municipal code is relatively clear. It just clarifies existing law. And I would submit to the court that Mr. Farrell, despite the arguments made, has never been a Joliet Township trustee. He was not qualified at the time of taking the oath. It was void ab initio at the beginning. There has been no change in that position by the Illinois Prison and Review Board, and I would ask that the ruling of the trial court be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, you may.
I want to get this out of the
way.
Well,
excuse me. Counsel, you may reply.
Get this out of the way right from the beginning. This has been the state's method the entire case. dirty up Mr. Farrell and then make their legal argument. He's been called a career criminal. He's been called all other forms of names by the state. This affidavit about getting paid was true at the time that he gave it. They suspended his pay even though he held the office because the state's attorney told them to. They then began paying him again. We had nothing to do with it. The supervisor of the township started those paychecks. It was after he submitted that affidavit. He did not submit a false affidavit, and he is not a career criminal. So put that aside. I'd like to address three things briefly in the reply. First, real quickly, the Rule 19 Supreme Court violation is a red herring. I cited the cases in my brief. No notice was required based on the clear language of Rule 19. However, if you decide that notice was required in some way, shape, or form, we gave notice. The state's attorney is the plaintiff in this case. They had notice. We didn't need to give anybody any notice other than that. Finally, late notice, and we gave it after they raised it at the last minute in the argument before the court on the summary judgment motion, the dispositive motions in this case. Mr. Farrell raised it for the first time orally. Several days later, that notice went to the Attorney General. It's attached, and it was attached to my motion to reconsider. It's in the record. That notice was good notice to the AG. They have never sought to intervene in this case. I've cited Supreme Court cases here in my brief. Late notice can be good notice. The court can also permit late notice to be compliance with Rule 19. And finally, the Supreme Court case that's in my brief, failure to give Rule 19 notice does not deprive you of jurisdiction, the trial court or this court, to decide the constitutional challenge. It simply does not, and our Supreme Court has said it's not. So that Rule 19 violation is a red herring. Secondly, let's put this issue of retroactivity to bed. Walker versus Agpawa, a Illinois Supreme Court case from 2021, stands for the proposition that retroactivity is valid. Mr. Agpawa got his pardon from the governor after he was elected to the office. He was reinstated to that office. There was actually a motion filed in court unopposed by the state after that decision came down that said we hear essentially called the case moot. And the challenge was over. So this idea that retroactivity doesn't count is...
So is that a non-pro-tunk type of activity?
You could characterize it that way, Judge. I believe that, one, the governor has unlimited power under our Constitution to give pardons and other relief without limit. And there's nothing in the statute as amended. And as you know, and it's in our briefs, the municipal code and the election code were both amended after Agpawa to clarify. I know that the language says this is a clarification of existing law. However, and I want to get to it quickly in terms of my constitutional argument, the legislature amended the municipal code, but they didn't amend the township code. So he can talk all he wants about how the municipal code and the township code are the same thing. They're not. The legislature didn't see them that way. They didn't see fit to make the same amendment to the township code that they did to the municipal code. So I would submit to you that right now as we sit here, there are three standards. There are complete your sentence and you can run for governor. Complete your sentence and get a pardon and you can run for municipal office. Can't run for township office if you're a convicted felon, period. And I would say my argument has two prongs on the unconstitutionality. There's no rational basis for the difference between constitutional created offices and legislative created offices. And I would direct you to Ryan versus Coles and say that you should take exactly that reasoning in finding for my client. And secondly, there's absolutely no rational basis for the difference between a municipal office and a township office. Both legislatively created, both similar kinds of offices. The legislature amended the municipal code and didn't amend the township code. There is a distinction that violates the Equal Protection Clause. There is no rational basis for that distinction, and you should so hold. So I would, finally, with respect, I didn't get to touch on it, our pending petition for pardon before the governor. I asked the trial court to enter a stay, And I asked the trial court not to enter an unlimited stay, but to enter a limited stay. The trial court could revisit it after our hearing for the pardon or restoration of rights. And I believe you also have the power to do that. So I would suggest to you, and it's in my prayer for relief, and I'll finish up now. I would suggest to you that you have the power to reverse the trial court on any of the three affirmative defenses, or you can send it back to the trial court to fully consider the constitutional arguments, which the trial court did not because of the red herring of the Supreme Court Rule 19 violation. Well, finally, you can send it back with an order staying the trial court proceedings until such time as the petition for pardon of restoration of rights is decided. That hearing is set for Thursday, October 6th, this week. And I would suggest to you that a stay would be appropriate because if that restoration of rights or pardon is granted, it will make this case completely moot. And under the Walker versus Agpala case, that's what would happen. It will, again, much like you suggested, Justice Holdridge, non-pro-tunk. It would relate back, and my client would not be ineligible at the time that he took the oath of office and assumed the office. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Questions? No. Questions? No questions from the court?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, both for your fine arguments this morning. It will be taken under advisement, and it will